So I'm Pedro Roshan. I work at Google as a research scientist. And luckily, on Monday morning, Anders Warhol really did a good job on introducing the platform. So I just show you some results. I leave the philosophical discussions of paradigm shift and all that that came up on Monday to you guys to just do it yourself. I just tell you this is the chip, and I would be showing two kind of different experiments on this chip. This is a zoom in view of a chip. What you're looking at is essentially aluminum on sapphire, and this is a zoom in view of it where you see nine qubits. The qubits are these. This is a capacitor of the qubit. Is aluminum on a sapphire. What we Photoshop them, give them color, so you know what's what. These are the qubits connected to a readout resonator. And then below here, you see control lines, which are used to control the state of individual qubits. And there is Purcell filters, and then one readout line, readout multiplex. You read the states of all the qubits at the same time if you want. After going through some Hamiltonian of the system, you essentially arrive at this. So, as I said, Andras did a nice job on Monday. I wouldn't repeat that. Believe me, this is the Hamiltonian of the system. You have interacting photons, microwave photons that are interacting and described by this Hamiltonian. And let's just be content with it, and that describes the system. Let me just zoom in one more time. And this is how our chip is different than a commonly used chip in the following sense, that there is an object in here which allows you to couple the qubits together and turn off the coupling at the nanosecond time scale. It's very fast turning on and off the coupling between the qubits. So since this is the only part which is different, I spent a few minutes to explain how this different part operates and what it is. So you can understand the physics of it from understanding the physics of this LC circuit model of the system. This L and C essentially forms one qubit, and you have a little inductive tails, which we can use to couple the two qubits. It's a simple classical physics problem of coupled resonators that you can write, and you can see that the individual bare frequencies of the two qubits get shifted a little bit down to this coupling to the third loop, essentially. So you can imagine that if you put flux into this loop, you can get these two couplers to get to see each other or don't see each other. Essentially, the physics is kind of very similar to what this object, classical object called variometer. You have two a transformer which you can change the relative axis of them. So you can see that putting current in one coil can induce current in the other, but if the relative angle, the axis are start getting toward 90 degrees, then there would be no induction. So the role of this rotational angle is played here by putting flux into this loop. So here is the flux that we externally apply going into this loop, and that flux roughly translates to changing that delta. Delta is the superconducting phase difference across that junction, and it can turn on and off the coupler. So if you just go through algebra and see current here induces flux here induces current in here, you can arrive at the mutual coupling between the two. And then if you define the coupling strength to be half of the splitting of the frequency, you arrive at such a nice relation. And this delta essentially roughly translates to the external flux. So you change it and you see that the coupling changes. So it's done by spectroscopy or otherwise other methods. You can get to see the coupling changes from positive and negative. And as I said, you can do it in nanosecond time scale. So I brought you a chip, actually, that was nominal to the one that experiment was done on. So what you see is the chip inside and the 28 lines that are used to control the states of the nine qubits. There are nine qubits plus eight couplers, and then there are two readout lines. You do the math, you arrive at 28. Two lines for qubit, eight line coupler, and two line for any time you write the Hamiltonian and you say sum over, it means that we have to put another SMA connector in here. So it cost us about $1,000 per SMA line to to do the summation. Also, I brought this. It's this is for theorists mainly. Experimentalists, this is not going to do anything. So just theorists to feel that they, you know, they have done something. But really, you don't need the magnifying glass. Please don't touch the chip. Someone touched it. I'm not happy. I'm trying to find his name and announce it, but I have to know. Okay, so let's just talk about the physics question we want to study in here. It's a very interesting question. Can an isolated quantum system act as its own heat bath? This is very important because if it doesn't, the fundamental assumption of the statistical mechanic fails, and all the statistical mechanic textbook, right? Every textbook is start with this fundamental assumption. If you don't have it, you might just ignore reading the rest of the book. So we need that to work. If it fails, there is not much we can do. And actually, it's an interesting question because what we can do very easily for us in the lab is just create dynamics. It's just creating an initial state. It's very hard to create eigenstate. So you're essentially doing quench. You're not creating eigenstate, so it's just going to evolve. So you just have to get that H. So all you need to do to be sure that H is interesting to some group of people. And you are starting away from equilibrium by default, usually, and you just control it, and you get to, and you ask what happens. So it's very easy to do if you can control it. So it's a very easy problem, in a sense, to do it, and it's a very fundamental problem to do. So can an isolated quantum system act as its own heat bath? Here is a history, which I'm going to get wrong, but I'm just going to be brave and saying it. We know that in Anderson localized case, when you have a bunch of non-interacting particles, any amount of disorder in 1D or 2D is just going to localize, and it's just going to fail to thermalize. For a while, they were telling us not to be worried, that many body systems have interaction in them. Don't worry, they're going to thermalize, so we didn't get worried. And then all of a sudden, they told us, yeah, I should get worried. They may not thermalize. That happened in 2006 by a paper by Basco, Aligner, and Altshuler, that they said that, you know, in spite of having interaction in the system, no matter how long you wait, the system may fail to reach thermal states. And then lots of experimental works and theoretical works happen to establish that as a new phases of matter. But when you look at the literature on this subject, you see that the signatures that theorists are suggesting that you got to look for is all a spectroscopy or have to do with the eigenstates of the system, because it's, for theorists, probably is easier to do full diagonalization of the system. So they say that, you know, one signature to going from a Hamiltonian, which is ergodic, to go to someone which is many-body localized, is in the level of statistics and the distribution of the levels. You need to resolve the whole spectrum and see how the levels are pushing each other and whatnot. Another is in the, the shape of the eigenfunction, you know, how they are extended in real space. And more obvious one is in two-point correlations and whatnot, which I'll show you results on that. So we needed to invent a spectroscopy technique, which we did. So it's very simple. You look at the Schrodinger postulate of quantum mechanics. It just looks like a Fourier transform. It says the evolution of the wave function. It gets these phases, these just initial states and bunch of phases. These phase accumulations are the energy eigenstates of the system. And pretty much looks like a Fourier transform. So it kind of roughly comes down to this. You record the wave function, which we cannot, but roughly speaking, and then you just Fourier transform it, and that's the eigenvalues of the problem. So let me show you how it works, and gradually I make it more rigorous. It's not as casual as I said. There is some nice physics in here. So let's just pick up a non-interacting Hamiltonian. This is I switch back between a spin notation and a Bose-Hubbard notation, the lowering and rising operators. When I don't have more than one photon, it's non-interacting system, so I can use the spin language. So there are nine, there are nine sites, and you put one excitation, and you record these Pauli operators. You put one qubit, you choose to put one qubit on the equator, and then you evolve under a given Hamiltonian, and then you stop it and record it, stop it and record it. And this is pretty fast for us. We can do it. We can get a data point with 10 to 50 kilohertz. and then that signal, you add them up with this complex phase, complex manner. You make a complex time domain signal, and you Fourier transform it, and you get peaks. Well, if you're an experimentalist, you know that anything you Fourier transform, you get peaks. That doesn't mean much. right? So, but you can start to a different initial states. That means that you start to kick the system in a different place. It's a system that you're interested in frequency responses, so you can kick it different places and listen to it. Listening means recording this X plus IY. You can record it at any site you like, but you can kick it in different places, and you have kicked it enough in different places, and you Fourier transform them, you see that the places that you saw peaks start to lining up with each other. And I just Fourier transform amplitude squared, and I just add them up. And I see, long behold, I see 9 peaks, and there are meant to be 9 eigenstates in the problem. So there you go, 9 eigenvalues of the problem. But if you're an experimentalist, you know that you can find 1,000 peaks in a signal. So how do I know these 9 eigenvalues are the eigenvalue, the 9 tallest peaks are actually the eigenvalues of the problem? So I'm going to take a detour for a few minutes to explain to you that you have enough control over the system that my claim that these are 9 eigenvalues of the problem is justifiable. But before doing that, I want to put our method into a little more rigorous foundation. Just telling you that, look, you might think that how do I get eigenvalues and not eigenvalue differences? Because if you just look at the evolution of the wave function, well, you're not going to measure that. You're going to measure observable. Let's say you have an observable O. This observable have this decomposition in energy basis. And this evolution is really shows the energy differences. So you got to get a little clever, or you don't need to. You can collaborate with someone clever, and then you can figure out how to do this so you don't get the energy differences. So I'm showing you that, you know, obvious choices of measuring a particle or just random initial states, you know, you excite one site, it's going to just give you energy differences or give you nothing. So you really have to get the phase, you have to get the initial state and the choice of observable correct, and then this combination of them only gives you the energies and not the energy differences. It all rests on the fact that we are working with the Bose-Hubbard, and there is one manifold which can act as our reference place where there is no evolution in it. It only has one state in that manifold, and superposition kind of provide you a phase reference point. So that kind of makes this E alpha prime constant, so it can come out of the summation. But I don't know how to make it more intuitive. Maybe you need to read the supplement of the work. Okay. So this is a Hamiltonian, which I'm trying to claim that we can hit its eigenvalues precisely. This is non-interacting, is called 1D Harper model, is relevant to the study of non-interacting 2D electrons in magnetic field, the famous Hofstadter butterfly. But this is a ghost of the butterfly left. You only have 9 levels left, but this is the same Hamiltonian, but we are taking it to a very different limit. So this is a numerical work. You look at this Hamiltonian as a function of B, which is analogous to the magnetic field in the Hofstadter case. You just pick the, this is the work in MATLAB in a few minutes. You get the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian as a function of B, nothing fancy here. Now I want to tell you that if I go to the lab, can I hit these numbers on head on? The reason we are choosing this object is that because it's very featureful and we can see lots of features in it. So there you go. So that's when we did it in the lab with this spectroscopy method. I go maybe one more time back and forth and try to zoom into certain feature, and you see that we are really getting it head on close to what it meant to be. And here is the analysis of it in terms of error. The gray line is what we anticipated our quantum processor would do. The dots is where the Fourier transform method I explained gave us. And the color of the dots is how much error is in each point. So if it gets toward red, means we have lots of error in identifying or got too much wrong for what reason. And if it's black, means it's really a spot on. And you see on average, we have about three megahertz if you add all these colors. About 3 megahertz of error in this spectrum. So it's about 1% error when you do analog physics. So this is all benchmarking, which shows that we can do it. Now I want to go before theorists who like to see interaction get disappointed. I want to show you what happens in the case of interacting physics. Now we start putting more photons into the system, and then the U term in the Bose-Hubbard cannot be ignored anymore. But the object that you have to construct to Fourier transform start getting a bit more complicated. Nevertheless, we can create all kind of initial states and measure this two-point Pauli operators and then Fourier transform it, and you get a more messy pattern. But nevertheless, when you Fourier transform, you can start identify 45 peaks associated with the dynamic in here. It's getting harder to read them, but essentially the physics works. So how is this telling us about MBL versus many-body localized phase? The prediction is that you have to realize, you have to resolve all the eigenvalues of the many-body eigenvalues of the problem, and then you look at the level separation called S, and then you construct this R alpha, constructed this, defined in this manner, and the probability distribution of this R alpha tells you what's happening in the system. So essentially, you see that when this, or so the color here is the probability distribution of this R alpha. So when you see that when this order is small, R alpha, it takes more uniform value close to one or more evenly distributed. The levels come more uniformly. But then when disorder in the system becomes strong, R alpha is get to, tilted toward very small values. And meaning that getting toward the Poisson distribution and level stop to care about each other. So let me explain this. So this is just two cuts. One is low disorder, one is at high disorder in the system. So these are the dashed line are the predicted values, the anticipated values or theoretical predictions for the case that you should get a Poisson distribution when disorder is very large in the system. And then you should get a GOE distribution, Gaussian orthonormal ensemble, when this order is small in the system and you have ergodic case. But then there was a finite system size, so we would not get these shapes exactly, but you would get something given our system size and the number of the histograms that we collected, you get these solid lines. And the dotted points are exactly what we got in the system. So it shows the qualitative change of behavior as you go from one to another. Okay, I want to get to this. There's more into this. If I get chance, I get back to it. But I want to get to this another question that in what sense Anderson localized and many-body localized phase are different from each other. When you look at the many-body eigenstates of the MBL phase, they are not exactly localized on a given site. They're coming from the associated with this integrals of motion, you can, they're called tau spins or L spins, L bits, sorry, or tau bits. And so I'm interested to see, as a result of this interaction between the sites, where the two many-body eigenstates are overlapping, what would be the dynamical signatures when they are overlapping with each other, and if I can record them. So let's start with something which simpler. And probably, as I said, this is the simplest thing we can do. Put a bunch of excitation in the system and ask, where did they go? Here at time equals to zero, you put two microwave photons in the system. And as a function of time, on one of the sites, you record where the photon is. And you do repeat the experiments for many different values of this order. You see that initially the photon is where you put it, and then it goes down JT, this is one quarter hopping, it goes to the next site, but then after that, depends on the value of this order, it either doesn't go very far or it goes very further out. And then at a very long time scales, the decoherence in the energy loss in the system takes over and the photons are lost. So let's just analyze this and see what we are seeing in here. So we don't have infinite time, we have finite time, so we're just gonna choose this reference point as our best chance of equilibrium value. This can be disputed, it's a bit subjective, but it seems that they did whatever they wanna do, and then after that is where the decoherence takes over. So this would be our reference point. We are not brave enough to call it equilibrium value, so we just call it reference point. That's can be discussed. We want to see what is that reference value, what is the population at that reference value for different values of this order. You see that when this order is low in the system, That's in reference where for low disorder, when you have several microwave photon interaction is strong in the system, they have enough chance to reach the thermal value, right? You expect on average you have 3 photons, 9 sites, 3 nines is where number of photons you get. So you kind of see roughly this is the case, but it's drastically failed to get to that value when disorder increases in the system. And you have two photon in the system, again, you see this. And then when you have 1 photon, you don't get to see the plateau nicely, but the coherence takes over. That's the best we can do at the moment. So this is the sense that in Anderson and MBL are not different. So in the sense that we have the breakdown of ergodicity, that the cases fail to reach the thermal value with disorders is strong. But in like any other distribution, there is a mean value and there is a standard deviation. And the physics that Anderson and MBL are different, it goes to the fluctuation around the expected around the mean value. So you see that at time equals to zero, the recorded numbers are all close to one. The population is at the given at the site that you started, regardless of the value of disorder. But then when time goes by later on, you see that the distributions are very different than each other. So we are going to look at the fluctuation or the standard deviation around this reference value, around what we chose to call it equilibrium value. You see that in the case of Anderson, when you have 1 photon in the system, there is certain fluctuation, but it's not planning to go anywhere. It's just going to fluctuate around and it's going to stay there. I'm not talking about this fluctuation. I'm talking about this magnitude of it. This is the axis is the fluctuation itself. And then when you have more photon in the system, you see that the fluctuation around the equilibrium value is start damping down with a power law manner. I hope I had more scale to this, but we don't, but it's consistent with power law decay of the system. And that was one of the key predictions for the difference between Anderson and MBL case that we are hitting it on now. Okay, I didn't hope this video would play. So it's an open quantum system conference. So what about open quantum system? This is our scheme of study open quantum system. We divide our system to subsystem and the rest we call environment. And we record the density matrix of this subsystem as a function of time. So here you see the full density matrix that the magnitude of the bar of the towers are the magnitude of the reduced density matrix. The color is associated with the phase. So we are showing you the magnitude and the phase. And you see that we could record it as a function of time. And the next few slides would be just to analyze that. 5 minutes, okay. and this, how long it took, Ben? Maybe? 10 minutes talk time I have. Okay, that data took overnight. Okay, I had a note to say that. So this is an extensive data set, but it's not, it's still feasible. Okay, so now I'm gonna get to analyzing this data. Subsystem environment. Here in this case, we put 2 qubits on the superposition is a product state, not that hard to make. You put you put your system into superposition state, and then you just see what happens. This is coming from that density matrix trace of rho times this operator, essentially. Expectation values all average over disorder realizations. So I forgot to say that bar shows it's average over disorder realization. So you see that when you come to population, either on site A or site B, even if the coupling is strong, it doesn't go anywhere. It's kind of rather flat. So the particle is localized, but more interesting things happen when you look at the reduced density matrix and you extract the von Neumann entropy. And you see that it shows, von Neumann entropy shows this predicted logarithmic growth of entanglement of this entanglement between this subsystem and the environment. So that's what you're seeing in here. It just starts showing up, becoming more obvious when G becomes strong enough. And this has been discussed and predicted for several years, but the cleverness of the grad student was to figure out what initial state is very effective and sensitive to probe this out. That's the key that maybe was not unique to our system. I've probably other platforms could have made a superposition, but the key, but pulling this out was a bit tricky. Okay, so MBL has been discussed as a memory for quantum information. So we are trying to place it in that context and see what it does. So here we are looking at the growth of entanglement within the subsystem. Again, we start with this product state. There's no entanglement in the system in the beginning. So the vertical axis is not very easy to explain, but let me just say that it's just measure of the, how A and B are entangled with each other. It's getting trickier to define them, but roughly that's what it is. So in the case that, so you see that initially they're not entangled with each other. And then as time goes by in the ergodic phase, boom, they get heavily entangled, but then immediately they lost it to the rest of the environment, right? Rest of the chamber. But when you are in the MBL phase, gradually this entanglement builds up among them nicely. Another question, going back to the memory issue, is that if you put a Bell state in the system, it starts with the Bell state, the maximally entangled within the subspace, how long it, this Bell state preserves. That's the concept of the memory. And again, you see that, well, you got to work with the distillable entanglement, right? What makes sense is how much of this entanglement can be extracted and be placed to some usage, not just how much they're entangled. So you have to really think about this distillable entanglement, the useful as part of it. And it comes with different flavors and definitions. But then you see that no matter what definition you choose, it's pretty much preserved, and this is really the overall environment or universe or whatever you call it, that this goes down a little slightly, but that's how good it is. So if you really want to think, make a memory out of it, this is what it is. And in the ergodic phase, you see that it drops down fast. I was keep asking Ben, you know, why there's so much different thing. I couldn't make sense of this vertical axis, and I talk Michael like, can I give me what, how much they're entangled? And he was like, no, you really, there's a zoo of it. So apparently some of our colleagues, instead of helping us making quantum computer, been very much working on making more and more definitions for entanglement. So, anyways, so I have a few minutes left of my talk. So I put this at the end, but this could be interesting. I'm sorry, it goes back to the other concept I talked. The spectroscopy thing. So on the spectroscopy, I didn't know if I would have time on it. On the spectroscopy so far, I talked about where are the energies, right? We say, hey, here's a peak. So what is the energy in here? But we can also talk about the magnitude, like how big is the magnitude of the peak after it's observed. So this is telling us, for instance, when you find the ninth eigenvalue, how much, what was its intensity, what was its presence at the sixth lattice site. So you go to this peak value and extract it in this table, and these quantities, which are very close to the heart of condensed matter theories, like inverse participation ratio, can be extracted from that. So let me tell you how this is working. If you get this table of magnitude, you just can add them up this way or that way, and you can make participation ratios. Okay, so this is coming going now to the interacting case. You see, for instance, that as a function of lattice site, you can see the participation in energy. That you can see that 45 eigenvalues of the system has significant presence at the low values of this order across the entire chain. And as you go higher in this order, the eigenvalues of the problem get more focused in here, and you get to see more eigenvalue have a significant presence toward the center of it, but less toward the edge of the chip. So here is participation in energy in a space. So here you should think about the band or energy axis normalized. You see that the lower energy, lower part of the band, you get to coming from the less number of qubits, meaning that less number of qubits are participating in here. And then toward the center, more of the qubits are participating. And you see this thing, which is actually, I just say it without making it a strong claim, that this kind of looks similar to Anderson case, but this is just maybe coincident or something. I don't want to make a strong claim here. Right in the Anderson, you have the mobility edge, and toward the center are extended states, and the edge of the energy bands are localized states. So it kind of looks similar. Anyway, let me wrap up. This work is mainly done by Ben Chiaro, who's here, and Charles Neal in the lab, and in collaboration with people at various universities and institutes in Europe and Singapore. I do not have conclusion, because I think you would remember what I said, but since I saw you ask lots of system performance questions from Andres on Monday, I have backup slides which are even better than my talk. So if you want to ask those questions, I would have backup slides on that, or if we have time, but I'm happy to answer questions now.
So thank you, Petam, for this beautiful presentation. I guess there's questions in the audience.
Sure, I can do that, but okay. So I try to answer certain questions about performance of the device, and I have to go between chip to chip. This is a, I don't know, maybe 2 years old chip called Bristle Cone, and that's where the name comes from. So let me just start by saying, how is the single qubit gate performance on this device? I have 72 qubits in it. And so this is randomized benchmarking. This is done across the entire chip. And you see that single qubit gate.
That's really fast. Can you flip back so we can take in the plot? Because that's like a key plot to the whole functioning, right? The fidelity versus number of gates.
Well, the exponential fit of this gives you the gate fidelity number. It summarizes in the next slide. So you can get to see what we are trying to make it clear in here is that it's a system engineering problem, right? You can get someone to really beat one qubit or one qubit pair to death, but you really have to get it across the entire chip. So this is what the performance across the entire chip. And you see that the error per gate is, okay, you can sum it up, and I have the next slide with showing it. And this is the decoherence of that single qubit site, purity of the gate, essentially. Here's the summarized, the whole thing is summarized. So this is the histogram of the numbers I just showed, and this is the integrated histogram. So you see that, for instance, about 50% of the gates are better than, the purity is better than 10 to the minus 3, and then you can see that this number, 99.8, says that 50% of the gates are better than that. So we keep working on median, not mean, because we don't want to be biased by a couple of outliers. So this is the single qubit gate performance. On the two qubit gate performance, I have to tell you a bit of a story that the gate we are choosing is called this F-SIM gate. It's a fermionic simulation gate. It's a family of gates. And we can show here that given a given pair of qubits, we can bring this gate for all possible angles. And we like it because CZ ISOP, square root of ISOP, and all that is kind of subset of it. So here is the result of that gate across a different chip called Luxbert GMON 18. And you see that on average, the two qubit gate fidelity is 99.5. But this is the average number of the FSIM gates. These are different members of the family. They are not necessarily identical gates. Each of these numbers, each of the gates could be different theta and phi. They are close to each other, but they are not identical to each other. But we know exactly the gate we are doing. So it is a, on the readout, we are just to full disclosure, This is the readout. When you prepare one state and you read it, we get 2.6% error. When you prepare one state, zero state, and you read it, you get 1% error. Let's just focus on, okay, either of the lines. This is a technique to improve it, but just either of the red or either of the blue. And you see that that's the kind of roughly the number. And it gets more harder when you try to read the whole bit string of the system. But that's the numbers. And by no means is the state of the art in the field, but that's what the chip does. Crosstalk, I heard lots of you guys were worried about crosstalk. So this is the measurement of the crosstalk. This is the not the microwave, because there's no, we don't do simultaneous microwave very often. This is 10 to the minus, okay, let's see, look at like roughly blue. This is, again, different chip. That's the chip actually going around. So about a fraction of a percent is the microwave, is the crosstalk in the system. That would be longer, maybe I don't need to go that far. But now I can, sorry. Yeah, I'm done.
All right. Okay, thank you so much for telling us on that. Any engineering issue. That's I want to ask the physics question.
Sure.
On that, you show that the medieval localization spectrum on that beautiful Hostad butterfly spectrum is the experimental obtained. But normally, Hostad butterfly, as you say briefly, in that multi-fractal structure can be seen. Did you calculate that fractal dimension?
No, it's so small that you don't want to do it. It's just nine eigenvalues, right? And then barely they form three bands. So it's it's not the place to do that analysis. You really need lots of levels to do that kind of analysis.
Yeah, but it seemed to be that's the nine qubit, but still that's the magnetic field is that the it can be easily buried. Then it's just the eigenvalue itself, just too many. Then it seemed to be possible to calculate that fractal dimension.
Well, it did what the numerics did, right? Yeah. I was trying to show that we can calibrate the fluxes and that we know the capacitance and inductor of the chip. So there is no claim to our fractional behavior there.
All right. Thanks.
Can you measure or have you measured how your relaxation times and or line widths scale with degree of isolation or energy density of the
state? Right. We are always worried about that the conclusions we are making, how much are them related to these? You see, I can imagine someone would question that, how do I know that these things, so I said system and environment, and as if there's nothing else anymore, that the fact is there is. So one thing we are doing is just to do the dynamic very fast, so not get worried about that. But then the measurements, like at zero coupling and such, it kind of shows that our system is not perfect. So if you, it's easy to measure like single T1 and single decoherence, but then I have no clear way of knowing how to measure many-body decoherence, except that I can tell that when Ben created this Bell state, it kind of stayed there very nicely. So you see, this is not flat. And I would say that's kind of a thing that we have to get worried about.
I mean, imperfect isolation can be a resource too, because there's analytic understanding of how the relaxation time for an imperfectly isolated localized system would scale with the degree of coupling to some environment. So if you looked at how it scaled with how well isolated it is, you know, there could be useful information in there too.
Yeah, yes, but yeah, well, it's just earliest stage of this work.
Okay, so just like for the very general interdisciplinary audience here, can you clarify why nine? Why didn't you run, the middle nine bits in your bristlecone chip and use the rest as an environment? Can you explain the parameters that are making you run this on nine-qubit simulator?
Well, just say historic reasons. Nine was generated, but I think just picking a couple of them in the middle of a bristlecone and calling the rest environment is a fantastic idea.
Okay. And so in that sense, you know, you should be able to tune between, you know, very non-Markovian and hopefully much more Markovian reservoirs,
right? You have to really overrule coupling to these things that I'm not talking about.
Absolutely. So there'll be some limits on what you can do in time, but it seems like you could explore the interplay between, you know, in reservoir size, and that's a lot of the things we've been talking about in the program. So. Okay, thank you.
Now that we have a good hold of these 2D chips, probably, it's a good idea.
I want to come back to the MBL dynamics aspect of it. I mean, there's in this analog experiment of Markus Greiner's group, they could see that the logarithmic growth of entanglement entropy can be attributed to configurational entropy, where the while the number entropy was saturating, similar like your on the similar timescales, and then your localization, right, it's to the left curve. So could you do similar things here as well, would be my first question. And the second question is, can you actually see the saturation of the entropy? Basically, logarithmic growth says that you're not yet in the MBL steady configuration.
Getting to saturation was trickier because of the overall decoherence in the system and made it hard. So we have to either make the coupling strength stronger or work harder, make better chips or something. So it was really borderline that we could get it or come with a smarter protocol or something. But we don't need to make an identical copy or anything to do. The point of the movie was that you name it, density of states of who, it's just a matter of time. If you just need 5 qubits, density, full dense reduced density matrix, we can do. It just takes a week. It's not, there's a borderline. So no need to, we are not limited in any fundamental sense. That's why I have this repetition rate in here. So, So anything that comes from density matrix is available to us.
Okay, are there more questions? Maybe I would have a question. So the decoherence dynamics of sort of the MBL state versus more
this one
standard state could also be an interesting question in its own right. So could you actually induce decoherence maybe by time randomly, time dependently varying some of your parameters? Or
well, it goes back to the
experiment?
Well, we can slow things down, but also Elliot's proposal is interesting that, you know, everything is coupled to readout resonator. So if you get them close to resonator, you can do some engineering there. But it may be a bit more like philosophical that the whole quantum information, digital processing wants whole thing isolated. So we usually don't think along these terms of, oh, let's make it open, see what happens. You're not big fan of that. But yeah, I think it's slowing the dynamics. We're not going to make worse chip just for this, okay? But it's slowing the dynamics or taking out, the resonators by design have to be leaky and low quality. So that would be a place to think about a proposal, yeah.
Okay, so if there's no more urgent questions, then let's thank Pedram again. I should say that he has to run.
So he
won't make it to this discussion session. So if you have some,
I make myself available tomorrow, most likely.
Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.